What I thought I would do this evening is tell you a bit about the history of conservation as I see it, and a lot of it through the lens of the evolution of the World Wildlife Fund, and then where things stand today and what we might be able to do about it. How I came to nature conservation to some extent mirrors the evolution of the conservation field as a whole. I, as a little girl in Westchester County, I lived along the Hudson River. I was passionate about animals. I hiked every opportunity I had. I really loved the natural world, and I was a voracious reader. You know, anything that had animals in it, or the stories of the explorers, I wanted to be like Roy Chapman Andrews and the paleontologists, or, you know, maybe even Jane Goodall, if I could possibly do so. Well, in any case, that passion over time, I wound up going to Brown University, where I thought I would be a biologist, but it was all pre-med oriented, so I became a literature major. But afterwards, I had a chance to work at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, and found myself serendipitously with an opportunity to go with a professor to take care, to share childcare and field research with his wife. They had a one-year-old. A one-year-old who now has his PhD in ecology from this university, and whose wedding I attended here maybe about 10 years ago. But in any case, living in a tent on the floor of the Ngorongoro crater persuaded me that this was truly a life's calling if I could find a way to turn it into a job. So how do you do that when you've got an undergraduate degree in literature and no marketable skills? Well, I decided to go to law school, and I loved it. I really loved law school, and then you heard I wound up at the Justice Department with lots of interesting opportunities, working in constitutional law, and then finally coming back to the environment and nature. As I did that, I thought, you know, I really would like to know more about science, and so I signed up for a master's at the University of Maryland and was working on this master's in marine ecology, marine policy and ecology while I was at Justice. And so I was weaving together a multiplicity of disciplines at a time. I should say this because there are lots of young people in the room. I did have three young children at the time. So it was something that I really cared about, and it obviously gave me enormous opportunities, culminating in working with the World Wildlife Fund. So a brief history of the field of nature conservation. At least here in the United States, its genesis is a real movement, started at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, with John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt, indeed, and Gifford Pinchot, who was the first head of the U.S. Forest Service. The idea back then, John Muir was called the father of conservation by many, and he was really an ardent preservationist, passionate about wilderness, and founder of the Sierra Club. For him, nature preservation had a strong spiritual dimension. He wanted, as he put it, to save the American soul from a total surrender to materialism. So many great Western wildernesses were protected at that time with the enthusiastic support of Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps our leading conservation president. The Park Service and the National Wildlife Refuge Service were started around that time. And while there were debates over whether preservation was for the sake of nature in and of itself or needed to be also in the service of humankind, the predominant ethos was valuing nature in and for itself. Jumping ahead some, as parks were being created, the international conservation movement really got going right after the Second World War with the creation of the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources was started at the same time. As a global environmental membership union, which would support scientific research and manage field projects, bringing together governments, NGOs, UN agencies together. Then the 60s and 70s saw a burst of environmental and conservation activity. Important legal measures, the Wilderness Act, whose 50th anniversary has just been celebrated, the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts, the National Environmental Policy Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species was negotiated and signed all during that period. Interestingly, of course, given the political polarization of our time, much of these seminal pieces of legislation were put in place during the Republican administrations of Nixon and Ford. It was during that time that Rachel Carson published The Silent Spring, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb, the Environmental Protection Agency was established, as was the United Nations Environment Program, and the first Earth Day took place. A number of conservation environmental organizations had their genesis then, too, among them the World Wildlife Fund, the Environmental Defense Fund, NRDC, the League of Conservation Voters, and so forth. So turning to WWF, the organization clearly I know best, it was founded in 1961, roughly simultaneously in the United States, in the UK, and in Switzerland, to serve as the fundraising arm to support field projects of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. Our initial projects focused predominantly on hands-on species protection, on for iconic species like the panda, giant panda, WWF's logo, rhinos, elephants, tigers, whales. The money went largely to European and North American scientists to do their hands-on work in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and North America. Well, within a few years, the work had expanded to encompass efforts to establish and manage parks and protected areas. So the funding was going to ranger salaries and equipment, supporting processes to demarcate new parks. And so very important areas like Serengeti National Park in Tanzania or Wolong Reserve in China or the whole suite of tiger reserves in India and Nepal were established during that period. But then we realized that it wasn't going to work if we were simply going to have Western experts coming in to provide advice and equipment. It was imperative to have trained, effective, local members of the services of the parks or the wildlife agencies working on the ground with resources and good expertise. And so we began to work directly to support fledgling parks and wildlife services, to establish international training opportunities and courses, and also put a major emphasis on establishing and fostering, helping with the establishment of local non-governmental organizations, really recognizing that doing things from a distance was not going to be successful for the long term. So the next step in the evolution of WWF and a lot of other organizations in the conservation movement took place in the 80s, when we realized that in addition to providing training opportunities, we really had to find ways to give local communities a stake in conservation. If you look at the real-world conflicts, if you're a small-scale farmer in Africa whose crops are being trampled by elephants, or if you live in and around Chitwan National Park and your oxen are being eaten by tigers, it's pretty hard to persuade people not to view the wildlife as adversaries. So we, through a program that initially called Wildlands and Human Needs, began working on ways to generate revenues for local communities, to create jobs, promoting ecotourism and craft businesses, trying to create local incentives for conservation. There was a lot of intense debate also during that period about preservation versus use. This was a time of debate about should we allow trade in elephant ivory? Should we allow culling by the Japanese or by indigenous groups of whales and other marine mammals? Should there be a trade in rhino horn? The argument in favor was that, particularly in the case of the terrestrial animals, to some extent the marine mammals as well, that these creatures were really should be managed by the people who live next to them in the way that they thought best. It wasn't up to an international community to impose its will. The debates were really fierce because the flip side of that is, and my personal view always was, that it's all well and good theoretically to say that you can have a regulated trade and a commodity as valuable as elephant ivory, but it is virtually impossible, unless you're De Beers trying to control the diamond trade, to have a leak-free system. And the minute you have leakage, you have poaching and all sorts of corruption, which is, of course, what has happened in with elephants. But in any case, this whole debate really was underpinned the evolution of the notion of sustainable development. And at the same time, we began to engage much more in the political arena, nationally and internationally, working to influence the policies of the multilateral development banks, aid agencies, and national governments. We realized that the work on the ground had to have a counterpart in the policy arena. And we also began looking at conservation financing mechanisms, the conservation community working on debt for nature swaps, which you may have heard about at a time when a lot of developing countries had substantial debt they weren't repaying, and the notion was to negotiate with a debtor country in exchange for some forgiveness of the debt, to allocate resources for nature conservation. The idea of conservation trust funds emerged at that time. These mechanisms have now generated hundreds of millions of dollars for conservation quite successfully. And from there, the work expanded to tackle global threats. So from species to spaces to training to community work to policy work and financing, then you look at the overarching global threats that are assaulting the natural world, predominantly deforestation, fisheries overexploitation, and climate change. To do that, we took a step back and said, well, we have to set biological priorities. You can't do everything everywhere. And so the conservation community and the World Bank and others came together around a template to identify the most important biological, ecological regions on the planet, ecoregions, whether terrestrial or marine. And that's a framework that continues to have prominence today. In any case, So, moving to the work to deal with these global threats led to our first forays into the marketplace, into trying to influence markets. And so as a tool to address deforestation, rampant deforestation, particularly in the tropics, we helped to put together something called the Forest Stewardship Council, which provides independent third-party certification that timber and timber products, including paper, have come from sustainably managed sources. It has its own logo, it has its own board, and in its early phases was not very well received by the forestry industry, which, though, encouragingly came back and said, we don't like your standards, but we're elevating our standards. The whole certification movement really had much of its origins in that work to create the Forest Stewardship Council. And then similarly, we helped with the creation of a Marine Stewardship Council to do the same thing with fish products. So working with the salmon fishing industry, both big commercial industries and small artisanal businesses, to be able to provide a seal of approval. So if you go to Whole Foods, for example, the salmon is Marine Stewardship Council certified as having been fished responsibly. Again, an independent third-party verification mechanism. So the goal was to have both local presence and global reach. Let me give you a couple of examples of how intertwined and multifaceted these challenges are. First, in Gabon. Gabon is home in Central West Africa, home to good populations of great apes, gorillas and chimpanzees among them. Chimpanzees were being poached at an alarming rate. And so what was our response? Well, the first thing was, of course, where do the chimpanzees live? How many of them are there? Are the populations viable? And so forth. The next step is to say, okay, are these areas protected? What are the management schemes? Do they have sufficient resources? Are there trained guards? Are there, you know, trained scientists locally to work on this project? Are there wildlife, human conflicts in this scenario? But then a basic question, who are the poachers? And the answer was they weren't people from the forest communities. They were not urban dwellers, but they were coming from villages and were coming down logging roads that had been built into the forests because they had more ready access. And so that led to working with the government on where you site forest concessions and how you police forest concessions. We realized too that this market wasn't going for meeting the subsistence needs of even these local villages. This bushmeat would go into the larger cities because it had become quite fashionable to eat chimpanzee and other things. In any case, the next question was, well, all right, we have these people who are coming down the logging roads. Who are they exactly? And learned that some number of them were displaced artisanal fishermen from the coasts. Gabon and along that whole coast, there have been an enormous array of really important fisheries that had been vacuum cleaned up by foreign fishing vessels, heavily subsidized by the countries of flag origin. So you'd have a Spanish fishing vessel parking off the coast and just taking every fish they could, with the result that the local fishermen had nothing in the lagoons. So starting from concern about poaching of chimpanzees for bushmeat, you find yourself all the way back working with the World Trade Organization on eliminating distorting subsidies. A similar example in Indonesia, a very important forest called Teso Nilo that's home to orangutans and tigers and elephants and a huge array of vascular plants. Industrial exploitation had wiped out a lot of the forest, and protecting the remainder was really a race against time. The tree traveled widely, and an Indonesian company logged and pulped it, a European company turned it into paper in its Chinese factory. The paper then went to wholesalers and resellers, who in turn sold it to consumers around the world for home and office use. And along the way, export credit agencies supported investment. So to protect Teso Nilo and its wildlife required not only community engagement and activism, stepped up anti-poaching controls and the traditional approaches to conservation, but also identifying and working with a chain of investors, creditors, processors, merchants, and consumers involved with a Teso tree. Okay, so that was where we were when I left WWF as the president in 2005. I've stayed involved with the organization as president emerita, but I'm not involved in a hands-on way. And so when Professor Tim Beatley got in touch with me last summer and said, would I be interested in coming to talk, I thought, well, I feel a little dated. I really ought to immerse myself a bit more in what's really happening in the conservation arena. And so I decided that the best way and the most enjoyable way to steep myself in what's going on in the conservation world would be to interview leaders with whom I've worked over the years, from government, NGOs, foundations, the private sector, and ask them to answer the following questions. What do you see as the greatest opportunities and priorities in conservation? What do you see as the greatest challenges? How well do you think the environmental community is responding? And do you remain an optimist about the future of nature? Well, plainly, the assaults on the natural world are huge. You may have seen in the paper according to this World Wildlife Fund Living Planet report, since 1970, the world has lost more than 50% of its vertebrate species, of its populations of vertebrate species, so mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish. Habitat loss and degradation and overexploitation are driving the bulk of that, but close behind is climate change. And that is a threat which continues to mount. Human demands on resources are unsustainable and increasing. We need, said the same report, 1.5 Earths to provide the ecological services we currently use and need. In this Anthropocene age, we cut trees faster than they mature, harvest more fish than the oceans can replenish, emit more carbon into the atmosphere than forests and oceans can absorb. And the effects are most deeply felt in low-income countries where populations are already struggling to eke out their livelihoods. Human population growth has slowed some, but we are at 7 billion now and slated to maybe 9.5 billion by 2050. And global temperature continues to rise. The planet has warmed 0.8 degrees Celsius since 1880, but two-thirds of that is since 1975. We're on track to more than double current greenhouse gas concentrations by the end of the century, yielding average global temperatures up between 3 and 8 degrees Celsius. So this is a pretty daunting picture. So what did I hear from these wonderful colleagues and experts? Interestingly, a lot of themes converged. So first, on the question of opportunities and priorities, they said you have to work more intensively with the private sector. One person emphasized that the activities of the 100 largest companies in the world have more impact on the global carbon footprint than many countries. Companies, they say, influencing companies really can move the needle. And it was has in fact been the commitments of a number of companies that were showcased in last month's UN Climate Change Summit in New York. Corporate giants including Kellogg's, Nestle, Cargill, Asia Pulp and Paper signed the pledge to halve the rate of deforestation by the end of this decade, to restore hundreds of millions of acres of degraded land, and to halt the loss of natural forests by 2030. This could eliminate 4.5 to 8.5 tons of carbon emissions a year, which is equal to taking half the world's cars off the road. It could help limit global average temperature increase to the international 2 degrees Celsius target. They point to the opportunities that seem much closer now for renewable energy to become truly cost-effective and competitive with fossil fuels. And also to the commitments that companies have made to reduce water use and restore watersheds. So we've seen a real change since I left WWF in the attitudes of a lot of companies. Those who are taking environmental steps are not outliers anymore. They're not the majority, but there is a movement, and it is in part, I think, because sustainability issues really have started to bite them, you know, and the bottom lines have been affected. So number one, work with the private sector. Second, and relatedly, these folks said, focus on intensified sustainable agriculture. As population and consumption grow, we need to freeze the footprint of food by improving efficiency and productivity while reducing waste and shifting consumption. Unilever was the first company to agree to buy only certified palm oil and has stated that all the raw materials it buys will be sustainable by 2020. The time has come, they say, to move the least sustainable actors. Stop going after the easy pickings, but let's try and move whole sectors. And technology is helping. You know, there are better seeds. There's better with cell phones. You can connect it to satellites. You can find out about local soil moisture levels. And so even rural farmers in very remote places have access to a lot of more technological information than they have until now. And another piece of this is to try to transform the way we teach about agriculture in our educational systems and really begin to emphasize the power of innovation as we work to reduce the agricultural footprint in a world in which where hamburger is becoming both desired and the norm with its huge ecological footprint. The third theme was focus on China. China now accounts for almost 30% of the world's CO2 emissions, and its economy and consumption of resources continue to grow rapidly. The consequences have included the horrific levels of air pollution and health effects that we've all read about. One New York Times op-ed said that there were 1.2 million premature deaths in China from air pollution in 2010. The Chinese commitment to its economic development path remains an imperative. They want to meet the needs of their population, and they are determined to maintain political stability. But at the same time, the country is seemingly quite sincere in its commitment to move towards an ecological civilization. Encouragingly, China pledged at the UN summit to take firm action on climate change and has set ambitious targets domestically to move away from coal. So how China develops and consumes has huge consequences for the whole planet. Fourth, look to the role of cities. The urbanization phenomenon can be part of the solution. Cities like New York, San Francisco, Stockholm, many others have made commitments to sustainability, including reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, transitions away from fossil fuels. They've improved transportation, they've added green space, and are very serious about all of those commitments and really establishing models that the Council of Mayors, among others here in the United States, is looking at very keenly. How China's cities evolve is a gigantic question mark. That urbanization process is not pretty, and so it's going to be hugely important to see if we can influence that development pattern. Not easy in a country which may seem monolithic in some ways, but I think anybody who works in China knows that while the heavy hand of national government can make a certain number of things happen, including censorship, it doesn't really have a complete handle on development or on the development of new coal-fired power plants. The fifth point was to harness the power of innovation and new media. He said, you know, look how rapidly ventures like Uber and Airbnb have had an impact, providing opportunities to re-envision the way we live together and perhaps gradually dematerialize our lives. Cell phones and social media have transformed communications around the world and provide vehicles for reaching and activating billions, including the rural populations and the millennials, whose choices are key. These vehicles also provide a means to promote the transparency and traceability that can begin to move decision makers, including governments. And the final point was, and while you do all of these things, don't forget what you brought to the party initially. It is still important to work on species protected areas, training, and so forth. It's very important. It just isn't sufficient. On the challenges front, well, the trends are daunting. Obviously, I recounted some of that, and they're all going the wrong direction. Huge challenge, political will. Political will is lacking, and while we certainly are going to continue to need good policy, good legal frameworks, finding political champions is really discouraging. And then the private sector. Well, working with the private sector in order to shape markets holds promise to have lots of leverage and take things to scale, but it can have plenty of downside. Capitalism, markets don't work perfectly, and capitalism isn't benign. And so what is a model for the year 2100 of a sustainable capitalism that we can all get behind? And working with the corporate sector, with the private sector, presents the risk as well of causing those who ally with the private sector to diminish their aspirations, to be willing to accept marginal improvements beyond business as usual, rather than really striving for what is important and good. And then getting a long-term message out, trusted, and acted upon in a short-term world is tough, especially when solutions are complex. Protecting nature is what some call a wicked problem that doesn't lend itself to tame approaches. Wicked problems are ones that are characterized by enormous complexity. We humans do pretty well with linear problems, with simple ones, with complicated ones, because we believe there's an answer. But when you get into the realm of complexity and ambiguity, a lot of people just throw up their hands. So this is a huge, huge challenge. So then, how did they think that the environmental community was responding to opportunities and challenging? Well, the reviews weren't that great. They acknowledged that some groups have really moved and adapted, embracing non-traditional approaches. But they say, you know, environmental groups are slow. They tend to celebrate things that are too small and stick to their comfort zones. The groups are not very savvy about innovation and technology, and the movement, if it still exists as such, is characterized by entropy and moralizing. We don't communicate very well, and we put off many audiences with our doom and gloom messaging. And the environmental community remains very northern, almost colonialist, in many of its attitudes and approaches. So optimism. These are people with terrific careers who are, by nature, optimists. And indeed, for the most part, these folks said that they remain cautiously optimistic. You know, not that we're going to have the vast untouched swaths of wilderness envisioned by John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt, but we should be able to protect sufficient areas of important ecosystems, important habitats, to keep the core of biodiversity. They pointed to the fact that some of what has real advances in the Amazon basin, particularly in Brazil. Reports vary on how much deforestation there is, but basically that situation has turned around fairly dramatically with very strong political leadership by several Brazilian presidents, among other things. And some 17% of the planet is in protected areas. And also they said, you know, we are building bridges and moving beyond our comfort zones. So if we can form coalitions of the willing across cultures, geographies, disciplines, if we can produce more with less impact, if we can get out of the way of renewables, if we can harness technology and use communication tools effectively, then collectively we really do stand a chance of bending the curve. So where did that leave me? Well, it really was an amazing set, an energizing set of conversations, you know, terrific people whom I admire enormously. It did, in fact, leave me somewhat cautiously more optimistic. The conversations really reinforced the importance of leadership, possibility, innovation, initiative, and interdisciplinarity, all of which are fostered in a setting like this here at the University of Virginia. So I would simply urge all of you to keep your eyes and minds open, to think broadly and dive deeply, and invest of yourselves. At the end of the day, it is individuals who serve as the catalysts of change. And individuals whose initiatives spark the chain reactions necessary to save our planet for nature and for humankind. Thanks.